This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, boil some water. A movie studio is born. Then, ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for you, record industry. Finally, why are the Lakers the entertainment industry's home team? But next, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Welcome to the 13th step. It's The Business from NPR. Start the caravan, as we too often do, with corrections. In the introduction to our interview with screenwriters Andrea King and Andy Marks, we erroneously said that they had sold two pitches for, quote, high six figures. So as not to alarm any IRS agents listening, they reminded us that only one of their pitches, called Tour de Franc, went for that much. They literally gave away the other idea, called Squeezed, for a paltry mid-six figures. And in our story about USC Film School's first pitch event, we mistakenly identified master's candidate Tom Beecher as Scott Beecher, to which we reply, Tom, if the worst thing you're called during your time in Hollywood is Scott, you got off easy. Last week wasn't just rough at the business. It was rough in the business. It seems that computer hackers figured out a way to crack the copy protection on high-definition DVDs. To make matters worse, news organizations and online news aggregators like Dig.com published the 16-digit code used to crack the HD DVD anti-piracy technology. Cease and desist letters flew out of studios' legal departments, and Dig initially complied, taking down stories related to the security breach. But just hours later, realizing on which side its bread was buttered, the website chose to reinstate articles that contained the code. In related news, it appears that rampant piracy has taken a toll on the content of Hollywood's movies themselves. Faced with shorter and shorter release cycles due to the pirates, studios are aiming to reach the broadest possible audience, no matter what. For instance, Warner Brothers Pictures plans to release its feature adaptation of Speed Racer with a G rating, even though it's being directed by the same guys that brought you the ultra-violent Matrix movies. Then, Vanity Fair broke the story that the fourth Die Hard movie, originally entitled Live Free or Die Hard, was going to be cut down from a PG-13 from an R. Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Hubbard! Finally, pundits were writing off movie theater owners 2 years ago, as box office was plunging due to high-def TV, video games, MySpace, and DVDs. Well, it might be time to write them back on again. 2 weeks ago, Cinemark Holdings, owner of the country's third-largest theater chain, floated shares in an IPO which generated just over $500 million. And last week, AMC Entertainment, the number two chain, launched an IPO estimated to haul in $750 million. Why now? Well, we can give you three good reasons. Spider-Man 3, Shrek 3, and Pirates of the Caribbean 3. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later in the program, rough times ahead for the record labels. But coming up next, congratulations! It's a bouncing baby movie studio. We've talked a lot about the bloated budgets of Hollywood blockbusters these days, but even the studios think it makes sense to roll the dice for a paltry $10 or $20 million in the hopes of hitting another My Big Fat Greek Wedding now and then. So they created specialty divisions, Fox Searchlight, Paramount Vantage, and on, to do just that. Unfortunately, they can still be infected by the kind of cookie-cutter thinking of their parent companies. On the flip side, the indie studios don't have the clout to play hardball with the theater chains like the big guys do. Enter a new player that seems to have found a potentially profitable middle ground. At the end of last year, Starz Media, the cable channel arm of media monolith Liberty Media, announced that it would fully fund a new movie studio called Overture Films. Overture will produce and acquire 8 to 12 features a year and distribute them to theaters. But they also have home video distribution through a company Starz bought just for Overture. And, of course, they've got built-in TV cable and pay TV distribution through Starz 16 movie channels. But, perhaps most importantly, Liberty Media and Starz are not studios locked into old ways of looking at movie making. Chris McGurk is a veteran movie exec who's been tapped as Overture's CEO. Chris McGurk, welcome to the business.
Thanks for having me.
How did Overture come into being? What was it responding to? It's kind of a craziness in the movie business right now, and Overture is a response to that, right?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Well, a couple of years ago, after we had sold MGM, which was the last sort of high-level executive job that I had in this business, we really looked around and saw that there was an opportunity to create a new kind of studio, sort of for poised for the realities of the business in the 21st century, trying to address a lot of the issues out there that the other majors, because of the way they're set up, you know, really weren't able to address. So that was about 2 years ago when the kernel of the idea was first generated.
So what are they doing, and what are you doing that's different from that? I mean, things are kind of nutty right now because why? Well, I'll let you tell it. You were on the other end and behind the big desk with the big phone and the big cigar.
Yeah, when you're a big multimedia company and need to make movies, need to be in the content business in order to service your distribution channels and service your library, you're almost forced to, in order to be competitive, to spend big amounts of money to do these big tentpole movies that you see out there right now, where now it's not unheard of to have movies costing $100, $150, $200, $300 million in the case of Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got that level of investment in a single project, it generates all sorts of craziness in the development and the production process.
Yeah, you wind up drinking a lot of scotch and Pepto-Bismol in the morning.
You really do, either consciously or unconsciously, spend 90% of your time, whether you're an executive or an agent or a filmmaker, figuring out how not to make mistakes, how to cover your downside risk, and what that leads to are formulaic, crummy, lower-quality movies, by and large, at least in my view. Mm-hmm. And it also leads to an extraordinarily frustrating filmmaking process for both executives and filmmakers who really can't make the kind of movies and take the kind of creative risks that they wanted to when they originally got involved in the movie business. And Overture was really set up as an answer to that overriding issue.
So why do we need another studio now? What's going to be done differently at Overture?
Well, I think there are two things, if I can simplify, that we're gonna do differently. One, we're going to try to create an environment where filmmakers can come, as I said a second ago, and make their movie. And that's why we're focused on movies that cost below $25 or $30 million, because that's really the budget category where the risk on any one project is low enough that you really can bring a filmmaker on board, agree on the creative concept, agree on the fiscal parameters of the budget, and then let them go and make their movie. Yeah, so what we're doing is we're setting up an organization where we have a very, very limited number of people in our own production and acquisition department. And the type of person is very, very different than the studios. First, the studios have 10 times the number of people for the same number of films that we're going to be doing in their production and acquisition groups. I mean, they throw legions of people at these movies, again, to make sure that mistakes aren't made and that the movies look like something that has been successful somewhere else before. And as I said, I think that leads to lowest common denominator movies. But also, we've instead of hiring studio executives in our production and acquisition group, we've hired independent producers to basically who understand the process and can work with outside filmmakers. So we've got a very limited team here, and we're basically opening up our space to have filmmakers come on board and create the kind of artist-friendly environment that existed years ago under the old United Artists. So I think creatively, the concept for Overture is sort of a 21st century version of the old United Artists operation.
Aren't you worried that, you know, when you make a movie for that price, that you're sort of forsaking a certain audience, the people who are your bread and butter, who are shoveling, armloads of popcorn and goobers into their mouth and rushing to the Cineplex to see the next $300 million extravaganza?
Not at all, and I think that's the beauty of our model, and I think that's why Liberty and Starz decided to invest in our model. When you do the smaller movies, and I'll give you some examples from MGM and UA, like Legally Blonde or Barbershop or Capote or Hotel Rwanda or even Jeepers Creepers or Amityville Horror, all of which cost less than $25 million, you can take the kind of creative risks that I think lead to better movies and better financial returns. When you do a movie for $15 or $20 million, you don't have to do $100 million at the box office to make a very, very strong return on investment. If you do $20 or $25 million at the box office, you're doing just fine. And I think because of that equation, you can really empower filmmakers, again, to come in and make their movies and take the kind of creative risks that lead to movies that not just win Academy Awards like The Brokeback Mountains and The Little Miss Sunshines and pictures like that, but also pictures that break out commercially and become franchises in their own right, like we did with Legally Blonde and Barbershop.
Backed by media titan John Malone, Overture Films is opening up for business as a new studio with a new approach. Chris McGurk is its CEO. Chris, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
We here at The Business freely admit that the music industry is not our strongest suit. So we rely on experts in the field to keep us informed. Recently, one of our music consiglieri, New York Times music business reporter Jeff Leeds, sent us the following email. Quote, "If you've been waiting for the right moment to do something on the music industry's collapse, you might want to consider that the moment is now. It's pretty dire out there." So we thought we'd better have Leeds on the show right away to explain the situation. Jeff Leeds, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
So the music business, that's your backyard.
Right.
Let's talk about how sick is this puppy and is it getting sicker?
It's been getting a bit sicker lately, and that's causing a lot of consternation in the business. As a lot of people know, the sales have been declining pretty steadily for the past 7 years. And this year, that decline has in many ways accelerated. CD sales are now down more than 20% versus last year. And digital album sales have only really, helped out a little bit to kind of offset that, but not nearly enough to kind of compensate for the decline.
Mm-hmm.
So there are really a couple of reasons for that. One is that the distribution system that the music industry is dependent on, which is, retail stores, has been shrinking steadily. And, last year we had the disappearance and liquidation of Tower Records. And there's many other retail stores that have gone away. So there's simply fewer places for people to buy music. And so the industry is having a tougher time selling its physical product.
Before we move on to the next point here, I want to ask you about that. So is it because people are just done buying albums or is it something else?
You have kind of a mix of factors. You have just a simple lack of hit product, which is a pretty profound problem in the business. You also have people that are sensitive to price, and they're perhaps more sensitive to price in an environment where they can still either go to the internet and go to a free file sharing network, an unauthorized network, and essentially take the song for free. Or they can go to a place like iTunes and take a single song or a few songs for 99 cents. Interestingly, iTunes, which sells albums primarily for $9.99, has sort of set the new bar for what an album should cost. And so, people are walking into Best Buy or Walmart or, places that sell CDs for, relatively low prices and saying, if it's not, It's got to be $9.99, or why am I here?
What are some of the other tangible signs of this acceleration of the decline and fall of the record empire?
There's really two reasons why I think the sales have declined so dramatically this year. So one of them is the distribution side, is the side that says, there are fewer retail stores or fewer places to buy music. The other side that really hasn't been talked about is the sort of the content side, and there's a couple problems there. One is that there's just an incredibly anemic release schedule so far this year. For a couple of different reasons, there's been you know, we could probably count on one hand the number of titles that have come out from sort of legitimately star-level people. Nora Jones is probably the biggest one. And, you know, there's a band called Fall Out Boy that had kind of a hotly anticipated record. After that, I really struggle to think of sort of big-name mainstream artists who've come out with records. So it's not so surprising that sales would fall off a cliff if you stop coming out with records from big artists. It's only now, we're into early May, that the labels are starting to come with people that are sort of recognizable, you know, platinum or million-selling, you know, artists. You've got Avril Lavigne on the top of the chart this week. And in the next couple months, we'll see new albums from people like Kelly Clarkson and Linkin Park and, you know, bands and artists that have sort of a track record. But you certainly can't expect to, you know, to maintain the sales levels that you've had if you don't have, you know, your big artists coming out. Now, the other problem sort of behind that is that, you know, for many years, the industry has talked about the lack of what they call artist development, the lack of the industry's ability to kind of discover and nurture new talent that will go on to sell big. And I think that there's a sense now that those issues are sort of coming home to roost, because there simply is not enough, you know, talent and hit product in the pipeline to sort of keep the machinery running.
How is this going to affect me, the consumer?
There's a couple different ways that the industry is sort of thinking about responding to this, and it's definitely going to affect the way that music is sort of consumed by people. One of the things that they are looking at is the idea of, instead of trying to get you to buy, you know, a single product, they're looking at the idea of, you know, establishing a more sort of closer relationship with fans. And so one idea that's being talked about is, can we take an artist and sort of get their fans and any new fans to sort of subscribe to them? So rather than buying sort of one $15 album, you would pay some sort of a fee, perhaps monthly, and you would get a new song or a couple of new songs and a new video and, you know, other new sorts of things that would go along with that. If the labels are able to get into the sort of merchandise and concert parts of the business, they could, you know, you could get a T-shirt or a concert ticket with it. And the idea is to create sort of a sustained and continuing relationship with fans, because what they've found is that the marketplace is so difficult and so fickle that, you know, to have an artist come in and drop an album and work it for 18 months and then go away for 2 years to then come back, it almost doesn't matter who you are. It's just very, very difficult to kind of to expect that you're going to have continued success. And so they're saying, well, maybe we can, instead of people selling one, you know, one big unit, we can get them to kind of just pay a subscription and kind of trickle out, you know, little bits at a time. The other thing that you're seeing is that the way that the labels treat artists is changing, and they're sort of going in two different directions. On one level, you're seeing labels want to get into the business because they just don't really know what else to do, of bite-sized stuff. So you're seeing them more and more experiment with deals where they're only signing people for ringtones, or they're only signing people to record a couple of songs instead of an album. At the other end of the spectrum, you're seeing them say, well, maybe we can get really deeply into the business of this artist's life. We can say, we're not just going to sign someone to record a series of albums for us. We're gonna sign them, and we're gonna pay them more money up front, and we're gonna buy into not just their recording career, but their concert career and their merchandise business and their licensing and all that sort of stuff. And so it's the sort of record company as manager sort of model, which has been tried with bands like Korn and Robbie Williams and others, but it remains to be seen whether there's sort of enough of those kinds of deals to be done that it will really transform the business.
Coming up after a short break, more with Jeff Leeds, the music business reporter for the New York Times. It's the beginning of the end for the music industry, and we're talking about why and what's next. You're listening to The Business from NPR. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business. CD sales have been declining pretty steadily for the past 7 years, and this year that decline has in many ways accelerated. And digital downloads aren't making up the difference. We're talking about why and what's next for the labels with Jeff Leeds, music business reporter for The New York Times.
So much gets made of digital in these discussions. But as Steve Jobs pointed out in an essay from, I think it was February, Thoughts on Music, he said something like 97% of the music on an iPod is not from iTunes, but from somewhere else. Now, presumably that means either put on a CD and burned or, you know, just outright stolen from Napster or some other incarnation down the road. I'm curious about what role physical marketplace has for music. And in particular, I'm interested because the guy who's probably sold more records than anybody alive, Paul McCartney, as a Beatle, just did a deal with Starbucks. Talk a little bit about that and the importance of having a physical presence in the marketplace and having a tastemaker presence.
What you probably will see is sort of a migration from music stores, traditional music stores, to more kind of lifestyle-oriented places that want to use music to enhance their own image for whatever reason. So you've got Starbucks, you've got Hallmark stores, you've got Crate and Barrel, you've got different sort of more specialized retailers that are not really in the music business but who want to use music, you know, to kind of bring customers in or offer kind of a lifestyle piece in their stores. And so that's gonna keep the physical business alive in a certain way. But there's really no question in the long term, digital business, digital is sort of where we're going. And so what's interesting is and really challenging for the industry is that, you know, as we learn more and more about the digital business and how consumers want to behave in the digital world, you know, what they're finding is that there's a sort of overwhelming preference on consumers' part to cherry pick the singles that they want from a CD or from an album rather, and not take the whole thing necessarily. So, you know, right now it's the statistics are running something like 19-1 in favor of the single over the album. And the deeper we get into the digital world, if that kind of ratio remains the same and that the relationship is in the digital world, I'm going to just sort of pick what I want, you know, there's still a great deal of turmoil that's going to hit the industry.
Jeff Leeds writes about the music business for The New York Times. Jeff, thanks for being on The Business.
Anytime.
Sports and show business have always had a lot in common, but in the last 20 years or so, the line between the two has become almost indistinguishable. Players have agents, and they're treated like movie stars. And games are staged with all the theatricality of big Broadway musicals. That's no surprise. The people who own sports teams are often in the movie business, too. Philip Anschutz, who owns the Los Angeles Lakers and the Staples Center where they play, also makes movies like The Chronicles of Narnia and Charlotte's Web. But the fact that Anschutz owns the Lakers is almost incidental to the fact that Lakers basketball and show business go together in a very special way. The business producer Matt Holzman has more.
The mascot of the Boston Celtics is Lucky the Leprechaun. The Denver Nuggets have Rocky the Mountain Lion. But the Los Angeles Lakers have Jack, the movie star.
Well, and it was Jack Nicholson's surprise birthday kink that has been one of the highlights for Laker fans already in this game.
Jack Nicholson is the metaphoric heart of the Lakers, and his seats are a kind of physical landmark for any true Lakers fan. Craig Baumgarten is a longtime Lakers season ticket holder and a producer who ran Columbia and Lorimar Pictures in the 80s.
I'm exactly 13 rows behind Jack Nicholson.
But Jack Nicholson is only the most recognizable of many recognizable faces sitting courtside at a Lakers game.
The entertainment industry team is and has been the Lakers for quite some time. You know, that's the entertainment industry home team.
Denzel Washington, Mike Ovitz, DreamWorks Animation CEO Jeffrey Katzenberg, billionaire media mogul Chaim Saban, and Eagles frontman Glenn Frey are just a handful of the showbiz biggies who shell out $2,200 a seat for the privilege of sitting on the floor during a Lakers game. John Black is the Lakers PR guy.
Courtside seats, we have 124. You know, the 124 most exclusive seats in all of sports.
No matter what they cost, the floor seats owned by Endeavor super agent Ari Emanuel and William Morris CEO Jim Wyatt are a great investment.
I know the Knicks used to have 8 courtside seats, which they would give away to celebrities, which was mind-blowing to me because if I had 8 courtside seats to give away for every game, I would own this town.
It's unclear by what method the agencies and studios dole out their seats. One can only imagine the morning meeting at Endeavor or William Morris before the playoffs as the agents try to make the case for why their client should get them. What may come as a shock to you is that many of the celebrities you see in the front row of Lakers games don't actually care about basketball.
You know, this is Los Angeles, where a lot of it is make-believe.
Joe Smith is the former head of Warner Brothers, Capitol, and Elektra Records, and a longtime holder of Lakers season tickets, on the floor, of course.
I explained to some of the people on the floor that there's five men on a team and a basket counts for 2 points.
There's maybe 2 feet between the front row and the row behind it, but in Los Angeles, it might as well be a mile.
On the floor is a big difference from one row back, I must tell you, in terms of the bullshit, the prestige that goes on in this city.
Having said that, you'll find big names a row or two back, the likes of Leonardo DiCaprio and Dustin Hoffman. But for many people, there is only one row at the Staples Center. Producer Craig Baumgarten.
A big-time actor, you know, who's used to going on the floor seats, I probably won't ask him because, you know, I get it. But I've never had anybody, but that's my own censorship. I've never had anybody say to me, your seats aren't good enough. My seats are better than floor seats, in my opinion, for seeing the game.
The front row isn't just for the A-list. Having People magazine take your picture sitting on floor seats at a Laker game has become a kind of rite of passage for the up-and-coming star, the Lakers' John Black.
I got a call from people asking about Lindsay Lohan, who came to a game recently, and I really didn't know the answers to, you know, where she got the tickets from, and they wanted to know who she came with, what did she have to eat.
The question is, why do the stars love the Lakers? Why not the Dodgers or the Kings? Well, first of all, the Lakers are winners, and L.A. loves a winner. In the last 20 years, they made the playoffs 18 times and won the championship 5. But maybe more importantly, in basketball, there is a front row. That is, there's nothing between you and the court and the photographers. But if you want to see the real reason that the Lakers are the entertainment industry home team, take your eyes off Jack and Denzel for a minute and look a few rows back.
In the section I'm in are a lot of people in the business, and there's a lot of, like, glad-handing and stuff.
Adam Merrims is a producer who shares those seats 13 rows behind Jack Nicholson with Craig Baumgarten. The sections just off the floor where they sit is a seething mass of agents, producers, directors, and everyone else who puts the show and the business in show business.
Pretty much every Laker game, I reconnect with someone I know or see someone I haven't seen for a while. It's like an old adage in the business, you know, meet a new friend and make a closer one at every event you go to. And, you know, certainly that applies to Laker games.
Of course, no matter where you go, you'll find businessmen bonding over a beer at a basketball game. But the ball takes on a whole new spin in show business, especially with the insecure creative types. Back when they were working on a project together, Adam Merrims asks screenwriter Mark Mullen to a game.
Yeah, I was pretty blown away. He calls me up and says, hey, we're going to a playoff game tonight. And I'm just going, whoa.
In a town where the gift is an all-important element of the business, good seats to a big game can be the ultimate gift.
Fruit baskets, bottles of wine. I've had people send, when my daughter was born, a producer I was in business with sent a lovely blanket for my daughter. I'm having to jar my memory, but the Laker game comes right to mind.
Mark Mullen's a huge basketball fan, so he's not waiting for the call. He has his own season tickets to the Los Angeles Clippers.
Screenwriters go to Clippers games, and big-time directors and actors and producers and Jack Nicholson go to Lakers games.
For the business, I'm Matt Holzman.
And that's the business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Special thanks to Kate Beauchesne. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.